Conan Doyle talks to June Oxmoor about her father, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
I may tell you that growing up as the daughter of somebody who's very famous is a great strain. And when I was a small girl, I had a quite enormous ambition to achieve something in my own right, to have some individuality, and to have done something that he would be proud of.
Dame Jean Conan Doyle is the only daughter of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's second marriage. She was born in 1912, when her father was in his 50s and at the height of his fame, not only as the creator of Sherlock Holmes, but as a leading public figure in the campaigns and issues of the day. Dame Jean's ambition to achieve something he would be proud of was more than fulfilled when she was in her 50s. After a distinguished service career, she was appointed director of the Women's Royal Air Force with the rank of Air Commandant, and at the same time she was created a Dame of the British Empire. In private life, she's Lady Brummett, the widow of Air Vice Marshal Sir Geoffrey Brummett, another service connection that would have pleased Conan Doyle, who was in many ways the epitome of the bluff Victorian patriot. Certainly, this is the impression he gives as he looks down with a patriarchal twinkle from the portrait in Jean Conan Doyle's London drawing room, and this is how she remembers him too.
He was a very big man. Not that he was particularly tall, he was 6'1½". He weighed 16 stone, and he was very thick set. He was, used to be referred to by other authors in their books as Burly Conan Doyle, and genial. He exuded this feeling of kindness and interest in other people, and utter integrity. He had so many splendid qualities that you felt these when you saw the man. And I know, obviously, I would be prejudiced, wouldn't I? But when he came into a room, you could feel everybody stop and turn and look at him, not only because he was a famous man, but because he was a very commanding-looking man.
Are there sort of mental snapshots you have of him during the kind of things that he was interested in doing at home or in the garden, that kind of thing?
Well, as a child, of course, the great thing was that he invented games for us, and we had a tribe called the Leatherskin Tribe, and he was the great chief, and we all had tribal names. To my horror, as I was the only girl, I was given the ghastly name of White Butterfly. I resented being the only squaw very much indeed. But then he used to get one of our uncles by marriage to act as the pale face, and we had to track the pale face down, and he used to appear on the trail with a rifle, and he'd wave this rifle over his head in the correct manner, and the boys, they all had tomahawks, and I had nothing, but I was on the trail pretty swiftly.
We've been brought up to be rather a tomboy then, would you say, in those days?
Yes. I think there were two reasons for this. One was that I was the only girl, and one of my brothers used to turn round and say, you can't do this because you're a girl. And so obviously I had to, I couldn't accept this. And then the other reason why I was a tomboy was that we all hero worshipped our father, and I wanted to do the sort of things that his sons were able to do. I didn't want to be just a little modest flower in the background. And so until I was about 10, I was a great tomboy. But after that age, I'd met other girls and was really very pleased to be a woman, and I have been ever since.
But do you think this was his idea as well? Did he appreciate the boyish side, or did he wonder a little?
I think it must have been a bit of a disappointment to him at first, because both my mother and father had longed for a daughter, and then to have a daughter who turns out to be a tomboy when they already had two sons must have been a little much for them. But my father was very understanding, extremely understanding. And I always remember when my brothers learned to box, I didn't like being left out of this. And so I decided that I must also learn to box. And I think I was 9 by this time. And my father did talked to me, I remember very clearly, and he pointed out that it was a sport which wouldn't be very useful to me in my future life, but I wasn't going to be put off. And so he allowed me to have a few lessons in boxing, but I think mostly from himself and my brothers, who were very careful with me, of course. But he remarked that I had a good right hook and a fine loose left.
Was he strict at all? Did he believe in a system of punishment at all?
No, he didn't. At home, he was very keen that we should learn to make up our own minds about things and take decisions very young. And we were allowed to smoke. I was allowed to smoke from the age of 10, once a month. And then when I was 11, once fortnight, and then once a week. And the result was, of course, I've never been a heavy smoker. I don't smoke at all now. And then, of course, we went up to our grandfather's every other Sunday for lunch, and we all, whatever age, however young, we always drank the King's health in port.
For Conan Doyle, family life was a vital escape from the pressures of success as a writer. In the 25 years between the start of his literary career and the outbreak of the First World War, he'd published 15 novels and 8 short story collections, quite apart from the Sherlock Holmes adventures. His creative energy was prodigious. As well as the hawk-faced violin-playing sleuth, he'd also created such heroes as Brigadier Gerard of the Napoleonic Wars, the prize-fighting Rodney Stone, and Professor Challenger of The Lost World, and other science fiction sagas. But there was no getting away from it. What the public wanted most was Holmes, and more Holmes. Try as he might to cast them off, Holmes and Watson were with Conan Doyle for life. In this 1928 recording, he describes how the idea of the first story actually came to him.
I was, when I wrote it, a young doctor, and had been educated in a very severe and critical medical school of thought, especially coming under the influence of Dr. Bell of Edinburgh, who had most remarkable powers of observation. He prided himself that when he looked at a patient, he could tell not only their disease, but very often their occupation and place of residence. I thought I would try my hand at writing a story where the hero would treat crime as Dr. Bell treated disease, and where science would take the place of chance. The result was Sherlock Holmes.
From the time I was very young, of course, I heard about Challenger and Holmes and Brigadier Gerard, and the stories were read to us, and they seemed not like living characters, because we knew our father had created them, but they seemed very real to us.
Almost like part of the family?
Yes, certainly, like a relation living overseas.
Mm, that's rather a good description. Did he have writing rituals and timetables that were sacred?
Yes, he did. He used to get ideas during the night, and he'd get up about 6 a.m, and he would write until lunchtime, and then he'd come down and read us what he'd written. And then he'd go back in the afternoon and finished off, and by the evening, certainly if it was a Sherlock Holmes story, he would have finished that story. He made very, very few corrections to his manuscripts.
How much time and how did he do all the deduction side of it, in the working out of the plot?
Well, I think he thought those up during the night and during the day while he was writing them.
Did he follow up an awful lot of newspaper cuttings and delve into current crime cases and so on?
No,
I don't remember that.
No. I don't remember that, and I was in and out of his study a very great deal because I was allowed to go there even though he was writing. I wouldn't have gone into the hut in the garden because then it was definitely a question of keep out, but I would have known if he was studying papers to any great extent.
The particular magnetism for him, presumably, as for us, is the character of Sherlock Holmes, in
yes.
which there's obviously a lot of Conan Doyle himself, would you say?
Not much in the personality, but he was always very keen that Holmes should be consistent in his behavior and that his character should come across in a consistent manner, and also Watson's. But other than the love of justice, Sir Holmes most certainly has. They hadn't really got very much in common from the character point of view.
What about Watson? Maybe there was something of...
Well, loyalty, yes. Complete honesty.
Might have been a division of your father's character, almost in a way, between...
Well, my father said that surely a little bit of an author goes into every character. Even Professor Challenger, who was so gorgeously rude, I think, to everybody. I'm sure my father often wished to be as rude as Challenger was.
On these Holmes stories, he used to come down and read you. Was there one in particular that he seemed attached to, or one you remember particularly?
He didn't impress me as having a favourite, but personally, I can remember the Speckled Band so well because he took us to see the play of the Speckled Band. And so that sticks out in my mind.
In the next room, where the beam of a dark lantern fell on the open safe, sat Dr. Grimesby Roylott. He sat very quietly in a grey dressing gown and red Turkish slippers. Across his lap lay the dog lash with a looped end. His chin was cocked upwards and his eyes were fixed in a rigid stare on a corner of the ceiling. Round his forehead he had a peculiar yellow band with brownish speckles which seemed to be bound tightly round his head.
The band. Speckled band.
That band moved. I swear I saw it move.
Oh, yes. See the little diamond-shaped head coil up out of Dr. Roylott's hair?
What is it?
A swamp adder. Deadliest snake in India.
Has it been...
But... Yes. Stay where you are. He's passed medically.
What are you going to do?
The dog nest was loopless. That's how he carried it to and from the safe. That's how I shall carry it back to the safe.
Oh, for God's sake, take care. If that snake strikes again...
I shall take care, Watson.
Cedric Hardwick and Finlay Curry as Holmes and Watson in a 1945 BBC Home Service production of The Adventure of the Speckled Band. The public's obsession with Sherlock Holmes had begun long before, of course. As Jean Conan Doyle remembers, the enthusiasm of his followers could even impinge on family life in the Sussex countryside.
I do remember busloads of people sometimes arriving at our house at Crowborough. People who'd come out to see either whether they thought they were going to see Sherlock Holmes or my father, I don't know. But they were certainly not organized by us. They always arrived quite unexpectedly. Not many of them, but it happened.
How did he cope with that? Did he mind that, or did he quite like it?
I think he just took it in his big stride.
I'd like to talk a little bit about now about Holmes.
Sorry, Holmes is casting his shadow. Never mind, he always does.
He does, it's extraordinary. About your father as a campaigner,
yes,
for all kinds of public causes,
yes,
from miscarriages of justice,
yes,
to slavery in the Congo. And
the form of divorce law.
The form of the divorce law. How did this affect you as you were growing up? Was it something...
All very interesting, because when he came down to lunch, he would talk about the things that he was writing the papers about. We realized that they meant a lot to him. And I think he did a lot of good. For instance, during the First World War, he suggested life jackets for sailors, and they had these inflatable life jackets, which they hadn't had before. And then he suggested some sort of body armor for troops. Well, it was proved that steel breastplate was far too heavy. They couldn't operate like that. But at least later on they had steel helmets. And he was full of ideas.
Strange, isn't it? There was a side of war that your father actually enjoyed, if one can use that word. I mean, he did say that the war was a physical climax of life for him. And it's almost as if there was a totally different side to his nature from the very sensitive, imaginative, solitary,
yes,
creator. Would you agree with
well,
that?
Well, I think he was a crusader. And he would always fight for what he believed was right. He was a great patriot, but he was not a chauvinist. And he was very empire-minded because he felt that the British Empire was a great influence for good in the countries where it was. But in his books, on his travels, he always wrote about the fact that these countries will grow up and they will become independent, and it's right that they should.
That's very interesting, because I had a feeling in the 1920s he was living against the grain to a certain extent. He felt they were alien to some parts of his nature, I think. Certain developments in the 20s. He was such a Victorian in his vanity.
No. He was very much a man of his time. And he reveled in having two very adventurous sons. And, my brothers took him out in their racing cars and took him out at 100 miles an hour. He loved it. And my brothers was very keen on jazz. My father was very interested in this and liked some of the things he used to do, some of the dance people he used to sing. Something you will never have heard of called Barney Google. and yes, we have no bananas and things like that. He was great fun. He wasn't a Victorian at all. I mean, he lived through Victorian Venice, of course, and Edwards. But he was a man of the time he was living in.
In the post-war years, to the dismay of some of his more conventional followers, Conan Doyle's career took an unexpected turn when he became a committed spiritualist. He'd started out life as a Roman Catholic, then lapsed into agnosticism. The deaths of his first son, Kingsley, and his brother, Innes, were not directly responsible for this conversion, but they undoubtedly added to the power of his response. Thereafter, Conan Doyle made it his mission to spread the message of a personal afterlife.
People ask, what do you get from spiritualism? The first thing you get is that it absolutely removes all fear of death. Secondly, it bridges death for those dear ones whom we may lose. We need have no fear that we are calling them back, for all that we do is to make such conditions as experience has taught us will enable them to come if they wish. And the initiative lies always with them. They have many times told us that they could not come back if it were not God's will, and that it makes them intensely happy to be able to help and to comfort us, to tell us about their happy life in that world to which we are, in our turn, destined to come.
In 1920, he also embarked on the first of a series of world tours to speak for the spiritualist cause, taking with him the whole family, including the 8-year-old Jean.
The first time I remember anything to do with spiritualism at all is on the way out to Australia when my parents decided, and I could hear them deciding between them, shall we do it now? And they then told me, no, there's no such thing as death as the final thing. There is a life after death. And they didn't put it quite as boldly as that, but added up to that. And that it is possible, if you love people, it is possible to communicate with them again after they have died. And that was my first introduction to spiritualism.
What did you think of this announcement? How did it affect
you? Well,
from
then on, it seemed perfectly natural. I just thought it was all nice. I mean, who wouldn't?
Were there then any kind of, as you got older, the 20s I'm talking about now, you were in your teens, were there ever any seances at home or demonstrations,
there were seances, yes.
What were they like?
Well, it was very nice, happy events. There was nothing strange or odd about them, to me anyway. If there was a professional medium, one was always on the alert. However young you were, my father always put one on the alert to look out for fraud and not to accept any sort of message unless there was real proof and that it was something that couldn't have been produced by guesswork.
Ridicule was applied to him quite frequently when he took up the cause of spiritualism by the skeptics. Did this affect him?
I'd like to say that when he was lecturing on these tours, of course we mixed with the audience before they went in and so on, one heard people going in sneering and, you know, poor old boy, must be past the best and all this sort of thing, and a great deal of opposition from the audience. But when they left, there was none of this. I was standing outside and you heard people coming and discussing the subject very seriously. So he knew there was a certain amount of ridicule, but he was big enough to override it.
Jean Conan Doyle herself never became a practicing spiritualist. Sherlock Holmes, however, is still a dominating element in her life, especially this year, the 100th anniversary of his first appearance in A Study in Scarlet. If ever a human creation enjoyed immortality, it's the great detective. Hundreds of inquiries pour in from all over the world, including fan letters personally addressed to Holmes at 221B Baker Street. She's also kept busy with her continuing links with the services. Hers was a career that had its foundations in her father's belief that every young woman should be trained to pursue an independent life, a fairly radical point of view for the period.
He always thought that I would have a career and wanted me to have a career. May I just for a moment tell you something? People always think that he was against the suffragettes. And he was very critical of their methods. But on the other hand, anyone who's read a book of his called Beyond the City wouldn't accuse him of being totally blind to the case of the suffragettes. In that book, there was a character who was a feminist, and she had learned to box. This, I may tell you, was written in 1891. She learned to box. She had a pet snake. She was a doctor. And she was fighting for equal opportunities for women. And she put a very powerful case forward that women should be given a place in the consulting room, on the bench, and wait for it, in the pulpit.
Which of those careers would he have liked for you, I wonder now?
Well, I think he faced facts, and the facts were that my eyesight was so poor that I wasn't capable of working for examinations and passing into a profession. And of course, when I was very small, I wanted to be a writer. And I used to go in for competitions in a splendid little magazine called Little Folks. And once or twice I got the second prize or highly commended or something. But I obviously had no real talent for writing. And I asked my father, what shall I do about this? I want to be a writer. And he said, well, first of all, you must go out into the world. You must have something to write about. So then I searched around and wondered, what shall I be? Shall I be a vet? What shall I be? Anyhow, I never found any particular thing, because I had always wanted to go into the services from the smallest child, and this was not possible for a girl. And so not being able to do that, I couldn't, and not being able to write, I couldn't think of anything I really wanted to do. And when my father died, all ambition left me. I felt I had no need to sort of prove myself. I could just get on with my own little life, and people wouldn't know much about me anyway. And so I got ahead with my own life. And then later on, of course, the war came, and I had my great ambition. It was possible. I was able to join one of the services.
That's how it actually happened.
Yes, I joined up in 1938, before Munich.
Mm. And certain precepts of his, I mean, have influenced you all through your own life, I wondered. Something he handed down to you.
Oh, definitely. There's no doubt about that. But the qualities of his character were things which were impressed on one very much, so that one looked out for the same qualities in other people. And I particularly, of course, looked for in forming friendships and indeed for the people one loves.
Yes, I was going to say to you, did it lead you to expect rather a lot from the opposite sex, with marriage in mind, perhaps?
Yes, I don't think I ever had marriage in mind. I always had love in mind, because my mother and father were so romantic. One always imagined everything would be possible, and if there was perfect love, marriage would be possible. And I was so wonderfully lucky to marry a man who just was just absolutely wonderful.
somebody that your father would have got on with.
Oh, they would have got on like houses on fire.
That was the final program in the series, Father and Daughter. Dame Jean Conan Doyle was talking to June Noxmar about her father, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. The producer was British.